It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. Skype guest today. I have been meaning to get Steve Klausner on the show for about a year. Steve's got a really interesting story. He is an unsung legend of horror, let's say. Not only did he write his own film, Headspace, which came out in 2005, but he actually wrote the poster for Nightmare on Elm Street. If Nancy doesn't wake up screaming, she won't wake up at all. It's just one of the interesting adventures he had in an over 40-year career in advertising, which he just stepped down from. I've wanted to talk to him about horror for a long time, but realizing the legacy he's had in modern-day advertising, we talked a lot about that. It's really fascinating. He literally starts in the Mad Men era. What you're seeing on Mad Men this latest season is the environment that Steve worked in and saw it through to modern day advertising. He's got a lot to say, and I just want to get to it.
I've been in advertising since working full time since 1972.
Wow,
but it was not my first paid writing job. My first paid writing job was at a United States Army journalist in Fort Benning, Georgia. And they had so many infantry platoon leaders at that time running around, they didn't know what to do. And since I had been to journalism school, they sent me to the Post newspaper. It's a huge post with tens of thousands of people because it's the headquarters of the infantry. And that was my job. I went out and interviewed what was going on at the Post. It was everything from the results of the General's Wives Bridge Tournament to a very, at that time, very sort of fast-forward, groundbreaking race relations seminar that was going on among the troops. So as has happened in history, the military has been very much in the forefront of breaking down racial barriers, and seemingly that seems counterproductive, but when you consider that you've got a million guys walking around who are far from home, lonesome, maybe they're pissed off and they're all carrying automatic weapons, it's important to build civility and discipline.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. So yeah. Were you in the service then, or was it a civilian
job? I was okay. Second lieutenant. I was an ROTC graduate of the University of Florida, and my lottery number was 20 at that time. There was still a draft on, and you could either be in the draft or continue with ROTC, which as a state university they had. With my lottery number being 20, I figure, okay, I'll go for the ROTC program. I'll make more money, and I'll have a little bit more say in my future. And
wow.
As luck would have it, I had 3 months of active duty, which was called active duty for training, and they said, well, you don't have to serve 2 years. We don't know what to do with all you guys, so you can go home, just report for summer camp next year.
But that's during Vietnam. How is it?
That was during the drawdown of Vietnam.
Okay.
So by 1972, when I was in New York, huge demonstrations in New York, the bombing of Cambodia had taken place, polarized country, Watergate about to break, social unrest. It was like living in a Batman comic, actually. New York being kind of a grim and a little bit of a scary place.
Yeah, I actually, 1972, I don't know if you know, is the year I was born.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you've been writing as long as I've been alive.
I guess so.
And I also know exactly how long you've been doing it.
Right. So the military was drawing down from Vietnam, and they said, well, you know, you'll go to summer camp, which I did, of course, and which was just training exercises. Although it was interesting, I had a job as a live fire safety officer. meaning they trained troops with live ammunition, and it was my job to take, if a recruit was reckless, it was my job to say, Private Smith, you're not following proper procedure, surrender your firearm, which in this case was a loaded M16. So you needed to have a command voice. And usually Private Smith was about 6'3", but seemed to work. Everything was okay. Nobody shot me.
So when you got out of the service, you kind of had a your first portfolio then.
Yeah, I did a portfolio. In those days, before computers, I made a portfolio of spec ads. I read Advertising Age, the trade journal, and researched, had to research them at a library, use the periodicals index, there was a name for it, and you would read magazine articles, many of which were on microfilm. But there were days to do it going analog back in the day. And I created a portfolio of ads. I cut out pictures from magazines, and I used something called PressType, which was something like an iron-on transfer for T-shirts. But you would buy a piece of vellum, which had in different sizes and fonts, and put it on with the edge of an unsharpened pencil to make your headline. Then I would type up the copy on a typewriter, cut out the piece of paper, and put that copy, tape it on a page, or put it on with Elmer's glue, put that in glassine pages in a loose leaf notebook, and that was my portfolio, my spec portfolio.
Wow. So
that's how people did it, and that's how I got a job.
Was advertising your goal?
My goal was advertising.
Okay.
Yes. I read the book by Jerry Delafamina from those wonderful folks who brought you Pearl Harbor, which was, the title is based on his his headline for Panasonic Appliances, which did not amuse the Japanese at the time he pitched it. And that was the story of his sort of legendary ad man life. And that inspired me to make a career change and go for advertising.
Wow. Now, so you're getting in the early 70s. And if you're watching Mad Men now, we're almost at 1970 in Mad Men.
Right. We're right about there.
Is it bringing back memories?
It actually rings pretty true. Needless to say, what happens in Mad Men in one episode is probably what might happen in an agency over the course of a month. But they cram all these sort of memorable episodes into 1 hour because it would be pretty dull to see a guy standing typing or at the water cooler, right? The clothing, the art director is starting to wear love beads and Stan growing his hair and switching from a Van Lod to a Western shirt and having bell bottoms. I actually love that. In those days, the account guys, such as not so much Pete because he's on the West Coast, but the guy with the eye patch, his name is
Cosgrove.
Right,
Ken Cosgrove.
Right, Ken Cosgrove, who did have literary aspirations, but in a suit and tie.
Yeah, he was writing short stories.
Don Draper in a suit and tie because he's management. That was the way people dressed. Women dressed rather formally as well.
Wow. So yeah, because I got into it in 2000, and I always, when people ask me about Mad Men, I always say, "Well, you know, the problems they have, I've lived through."
Yes.
But all the fun, no.
Well, the fun. Part of the reason there was fun, there was a lot of time. In the analog days, when film was shot, it had to be sent to a lab. Then it came back. It was reviewed. It was cut. If you've ever seen Peggy's character on a moviola, running footage and then literally snipping it with a scissor and taping it together. Print ads, when they were made, they had to be set up in an art studio where a machine would generate the type and it would be cut with a razor blade and pasted to a board called a mechanical. And they'd have a sheet of vellum where people would write on it with a blue pencil to make comments. And there would be a department called traffic, and the traffic person was usually somebody about 50, kind of grizzled with a cigarette hanging out of his or her mouth, who'd walk around office to office saying, okay, when are my revisions going to be ready? Mm-hmm. It was a much more civilized time frame because the physical limitations of creating work, there was much more time in between assignments.
Right. And so then you were there also when the computers came in. It always seemed to me, and as I was saying, when computers really started to appear, I was still in school, so I missed this whole era. It seemed like they were always pitched on, you're going to have so much more time because this is going to happen faster. Was that how it was introduced in the agency, and then slowly you realized, oh, they're just going to keep giving us more and more assignments? Or were you kind of wary of that this era was ending?
Well, everything came together in a different way. When the computers came in and they were sort of everywhere, which was about maybe 1989, 1990, that was the end of art directors no longer needing to be able to draw, to sketch out ideas. All of a sudden, ideas happened on the computer. At that time, I had an Epson computer, which probably had, I think it had maybe an 8 megabyte hard drive. I don't know. And it had a dot matrix printer. But there was no email. So having a computer to write copy on and not to have an IBM self-correcting Selectric, that was sort of a time saver. And for art directors, being able to scan a photo as a sort of a placeholder visual and being able to compose type and kern the type and create a layout or a rough layout in computer, it was a great time saver. It really was a great time saver. Without email and any way to transmit that, you still had to print it out on a printer in black and white. So the time crunch had not yet arrived. In the early 90s, film started to be edited digitally. It was transferred to a machine at that time called an Avid, which probably cost a gazillion dollars and would be slower than you cutting video on your smartphone today. Nevertheless, that was a huge leap because you didn't have to go to a giant room, see film in a screening room like a 1930s smoke-filled like John Foster Kane or something, or I guess that's the wrong reference. But you didn't cut film like Orson Welles anymore,
right?
And so these were very good. These were really very good time savers and labor saving devices. By the mid 90s, when email came in, that started to crunch time a little bit. In the 2000s, with social media, with broadband replacing dial-up, again, being able to send mass files with not megabytes, but gigabytes of data over broadband lines, that's when everything got crunched. Then, I'd say about the mid-2000s, when the BlackBerry came in and was supplanted by the iPhone and then Android phones, that's when people went 24/7, and that's when I would say everything went to hell. Just in terms of having no time to think.
Right.
Even today, if you look at a daily newspaper, there are so many typos, and it's not because the reporters are illiterate. It's because spell check doesn't pick it up. They sit down at their terminal, they type out an article, punch a button, bam, the spell check doesn't cut it. It doesn't catch it. It's in the newspaper, or it's online because the online article shows up 2 days before the paper article. At J. Walter Thompson, we used to get we got seminars on, you know, how you properly source reviews or use somebody's name in an ad. There was a lot of concern about the legal ramifications of doing that. Now on the web, by the time people get around to suing, the ad's already pulled down. So there's no lawsuit. They just send out a nasty letter and things don't happen. So things are pretty fast and loosed in the cyber era.
Yeah, I'm finding that with my own portfolio. I was just reviewing it, and mm-hmm. you know, most of these websites where I've done full websites, well, I don't have the server space to put every single page on it. So I always put a live link. I would get a screen grab of the homepage and then have a live link. And then this week I just happened to review it. Every link was dead.
Because really?
Every single website I have worked on has been pulled down and replaced by a new website.
Yeah.
So it's like it. Websites, we used to think of them as like as making, you know, it was like making a movie, and now it's like making a print ad. It doesn't matter how big and robust it is; it won't be up very long.
Right. Actually, that's funny you mentioned that because I'm about to do a digital portfolio. Yesterday, I spent about 3 hours. I have two portfolios, and I took them down to one. And I threw out so much crap.
Yeah.
Because what I thought was good at the time was a lot of it was technology or cell phone or email based, and the technology was so old. I said, yeah, that just looks old fashioned. Out it goes. The older stuff actually is sort of more classic. So
like the print stuff?
Yeah, some of the print stuff. And I have some web stuff, which are web movies, which I have on DVD, so I can, you know, run those. I can put those in or make a link to them, I guess. So I'm not sure what source I'm going to use, whether I'm going to do that on WordPress or whether I'm going to do it. I guess I'll do it on Behance, but I'm waiting to see.
Easier. Behance is getting much bigger. Mine's on Blogspot because it was just like, I was just always throwing up the latest thing, especially when I was freelancing. It was like, well, here's the project I did last month. But now I think I'm going to have to think of something a little more permanent. But my first site, our mutual friend Dave Weskelevitz made for me in Flash, and it looked fantastic.
Ah.
But it was – now that's 10 years ago. Flash is outdated.
I know.
You had to be a designer to work Flash, so I couldn't do any of the updates myself. So it's just kind of out there in limbo.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm going to have to scan a couple of things and just put them up as PDFs.
Yeah.
I have some direct mail samples, and I'm going to scan the outside envelope and an inside spread, and you know, that'll do.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did.
Yep.
But while you were in advertising, I know you started working on entertainment properties. I know you worked for ABC for a long time, and I know you also did you did the first Nightmare on Elm Street poster.
I did. That I did freelance for an agency. I think it was called the Creative Directors, but I honestly don't remember. But an art director named John Wagman, who's a good friend of 40 years, and John now owns a stock photo agency called Global Photo Resources. I did a lot of film posters with him. He was working on a lot of the New Line films at the time. And I sort of segued into that. I started at McCaffrey & McCall in 1978. McCaffrey & McCall is no longer in business. They were purchased by Saatchi & Saatchi and ultimately went out of business in 92 when they lost their biggest client, Mercedes-Benz. But we did the ads for ABC News, ABC Entertainment, ABC Sports. We also handled United Artists at the time, and I did some ads for Apocalypse Now, among other things, and had the great delight and honor of being in an exhibitor screening. Francis Ford Coppola screened a rough cut at the Ziegfeld Theater, and Pauline Kael, who was at the time a number one film critic, she worked for The New Yorker, she had snuck in to review the film before it was out. And somebody found her. They stopped the film, turned on the lights, and security, and she was about 5'1", two beefy security guides took each arm, and they almost frog marched her out of there. That was pretty exciting.
Those were the days when Pauline Kael was the critic. This is before Siskel and Ebert.
She could make or break a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, is that when you started thinking about screenwriting?
I did, and at the time, this was before computers were in, typing up a screenplay format was time-consuming. I didn't really have the I wasn't educated in it. I didn't know the format, and it was very hard to do. But in 1987, I met a woman who was to become my wife. She was an assistant director and a criminology professor, Dr. Janet Fishman at John Jay College. And she
that is the most New York name I've ever heard, Steve.
Yes.
Dr. Janet Fishman. There is no way she lives anywhere but near Central Park.
Janet Fishman, PhD. The late Janet Fishman. Unfortunately, she died in 1998. And our daughter, who I'll talk about later, is actually a writer at the Daily Mail UK. I'd always had an interest in it. And then going on movie sets, TV sets to do ads about them, really, it just kind of got into my blood, and I always wanted to do it. Janet knew sort of the screenplay format, and we collaborated on a script which we actually sold. It was called The Telltale House, sort of a knockoff on The Telltale Heart, and it was about a house in Baltimore being haunted. In modern-day Baltimore, being haunted by the ghost of Edgar Allan Poe. I'm going to hang... Well, the phone's ringing, but I know Michelle's going to get it.
Okay. No, you can let it go.
One second. It's going to make noise.
It just sounds like you're very busy.
Not really. I'm just sitting here on the couch.
So was The Telltale House ever made?
No, it was not. But it was sold to Columbia Pictures Television, and then another company bought it, so we made money twice. It was never produced, and it started out as this creepy horror film, and it ended up, the last company that had it wanted to make a property for Heather Locklear as a plucky girl reporter. So we had to rewrite the script, and ultimately it went nowhere in as they say, turnaround hell. But it was a real education.
Wow. Now, how long between that? Because when you and I met in the early 2000s, Headspace, which was the film that
right.
you did have produced, was well along. I think it was in
right.
production when we met. What's in between those?
Well, in between those, we collaborated on a couple of other things, and then in 1988, our daughter Alexandra came along. So that sort of that took up a lot of time. As I know
yeah,
you
that's
know.
What I'm. That's what I'm trying to tell people now.
Yes,
they're like,
took up a lot of time, and I had to write. I had to work, and Janet had to work at John Jay, and she still did a little bit in the summer, a little bit of assistant directing on some films and things. As a matter of fact, my son Josh, from my first marriage, Josh Klausner, who is a produced screenwriter in L.A., writer
he has a film
of.
He has a film on Netflix.
Dead Season. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, which is streaming on Netflix now.
Yeah, it's a zombie movie. And he has just put a Dutch horror movie script into English, and I believe they're going to either shoot it or title it. I'm not exactly sure what happened. And he's working on some other projects. Anyway, she got Josh an internship on the set of a movie. That was, I don't know, was filming in Westchester, some TV film, and he, when did he graduate from high school? He graduated from high school in 98 and went on to USC. Anyway, I know we're kind of wandering, but yeah, raising two kids and having a two full-time jobs, it kind of gets away from those projects. Anyway, to make a long story short, in 1998, Janet passed away. Then I was really busy. I was just a widowed single dad with a kid trying to make it in college, a 10-year-old girl who was kind of in, you know, her world was pretty turned upside down. I was incredibly fortunate a year later to meet the woman who would become my third wife, Michelle Vass, now Michelle Vass, Klausner, who has nothing to do with show business. She's a number cruncher. Thank God I married an MBA who could figure out how to do our taxes and pay our bills and things like that.
Sometimes I think that's...
Balance.
Sometimes I think that's why Michelle's always in such a good mood, because she doesn't have these creative impulses torturing her on a daily basis. It's like, you know, my wife Renee is the same way. Just not a creative impulse. No, she doesn't need to get up on a stage or make a film, and she's so much happier than I am.
Family needs a CFO, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you need a realist in your house.
She's actually has an MBA in finance, but she's not a CPA, but I bet you she could be. at any rate, things, you know, life came together again, and there was some stability. At the same time, now a young man I had known since his kindergarten days, my son's best friend, a young man by the name of Andrew Vandenhouten, went on to form a film company called Modern Cine, which has done quite a few films, which I'll get to in a minute. But I get a call from Andrew one day, and he says, you know, Steve, I'm writing a script, and when I was a kid, you always talked to me like I was a grown-up. You didn't talk to me like I was a little kid. So would you give me some input on this script and maybe even help me finish it? I said, sure. So he sent me a script, which was about mind control and trying to win an election by getting in kids' heads and things. And it was never produced, but it was a very good collaboration. He said, listen, I'm starting a film company, and I have this script, and it doesn't have a title, but it's about a guy whose brain starts growing, and he gets smarter, and he opens a portal to another dimension. But it's sort of wandering. We need to wrestle it down to earth. And would you like to write it, co-write it with my producer and DP, William Miller? I said, sure, why not? Let's do it. So we wrote a few drafts. We ended up with 21 drafts.
Wow.
But we got the money together to do a makeup test with Udo Kier, the German actor. And we did a makeup test where a monster ripped his face off. And I basically begged a good friend of the family, William Atherton, the character actor, to be in the film.
Yeah, from Die Hard, from Ghostbusters.
From the Die Hard and Ghostbusters series. And Bill said, all right, if you want me to be in it, I'll do it. I think they, they actually did pay him, which is a good thing. People like Udo Kier and Bill and even Olivia Hussey, who was long ago in a Romeo and Juliet film. They don't show up and work for nothing. But fortunately, by then, Andrew was capitalized. I think he got some European money. And things happened. Dee Wallace Stone, now Dee Wallace again, played a part in the film, the mom in E.T., of course.
Right.
And an unknown actor, then unknown actor, coming off Broadway from Master Harold and the Boys, Christopher Denham, who's since gone on to be in Argo. He's directed his own films. He was in a Modern Cine film he did himself. He was in a film recently about, and I cannot think of the name of it, but he was in a film with, I believe, Britt Marling about a cult, trying to bust a cult or anything. Chris is having quite a lot of visibility now and is really a young man on the way up. So Headspace was made. It came out. It won the 2005 New York Horror Film Festival Best Screenplay. It won Best Creature Feature next year at HorrorCon in San Francisco, and it screened around the world, and it did okay. It was on Showtime. It was on Chiller. It played in theaters. So Andrew started doing some other stuff. I did a script with my son for them called Sorority Vampires, which for a variety of reasons was too expensive to make, but that was my sort of next endeavor.
Right. So how many, I remember you and I wrote two different features, and then sure. I helped you rewrite another one that you'd done, so that was like three more. But how many more features have you written since then?
I think I've done somewhere between 12 and 14, and I'd have to count them up.
And are they all horror?
They're not all horror. One of them is a historical feature based on a real person. It's called Queen of Thieves. Believe it or not, I started it with my late wife because she knew about, there was a woman in 1880s New York called Frederica Mandelbaum, who was a German immigrant, and her nickname was Marm. She was the head fence and ran, she was like Fagin in Oliver Twist. She had a series of young urchins and housemaids who would go around stealing, and then she would melt down silver and gold, that steal silk, which was a very valuable commodity at the time, jewelry, and she was basically, we called her the Queen of Thieves. That was our later title. And she was a real person. So we tried to write a script on that, and it kind of went, we didn't quite get it together, and then one thing led to another, and we sort of put it aside. Then I brought it back, and a very talented playwright, a woman named Jenny Levison, who she's sort of a festival programmer, a screenwriter, a playwright, a teacher, a social activist. I don't know when she has time to sleep. Anyway, and she recently adopted a young man, and she and her partner Josh live in Brooklyn, and they also shoot documentaries, some of which have really received quite a bit of attention. We finished the script, and we got partway in the Austin Film Festival. We got to the semis, so that was good. We ultimately did not get. We did another movie called The Golem of Avenue B, and again, we made it about to the semis, then the writer's strike hit. So you get letters from the Writers Guild. If you even show this script to your aunt, you'll never get into the Writers Guild. So I sort of put that one aside. But that's one we're going to polish up again. And when you're ready to talk about Ripfest, Jenny got me into Ripfest.
Well, let's talk about Ripfest.
Okay, Ripfest. Last summer, I got an email. Want to write a film in 48 hours? And I said, huh? So Ripfest, actually, no, it wasn't that. I was out in Malibu for the wedding of the aforementioned Andrew Vandenhouten, and my son Josh had by then become a universal life minister on the internet so he could marry Andrew and his bride, Kristen. And I get an email that says, congratulations, Steve, you've been chosen to write Ripfest. I actually thought it was spam. I thought it was going to be like, click on this link and pay $5, but Ripfest is a 401(c) not-for-profit kind of a generator for the arts. It's a fully funded film festival run by a volunteer group. Most of the people work at the various TV networks and film companies, CBS, A&E, IFC, places like that. And if you're chosen, you have 48 hours to write a film. They put together total strangers. Jenny and I were put together with a director we'd never met. We met three SAG actors who were working for free under they got a waiver. We met an editor who we'd never met. We had a composer who was a bona fide Broadway composer to do the score. Our producer worked for the showrunner of Law and Order, and we got a production office to work out of, and some locations. And they said, okay, you're going to have breakfast with your cast and your crew. You got 48 hours. Make a 9-minute film. And we had no idea what to do, but they gave us some locations. And this was at the time, right after the Defense of Marriage Act was overturned in New York. When we met our actors, one actor, our female lead, was a classically trained flute player who was now an actress and doing quite well, has been on The Good Wife, among other things, in some independent films. Because of carpal tunnel syndrome, she turned to acting and did quite well. She's a beautiful woman named Samira Lukman Harris. And then we had our two actors, one of whom is a gay man, one of whom is not, and they were both actors/bartenders, but also doing well. So we used their background stories, and we decided to write a comedy about the end of DOMA. And Jenny found a wonderful quote from Shakespeare, which is, "The course of true love never did run smooth." And we decided to make a Shakespearean farce in modern day. And it was about, it turned out to be about a couple who were going to have a green card marriage, so that the partner, the male partner of the other guy, could stay in the country. And basically the guy gets hit in the head, and all of a sudden he thinks he's straight and the green card marriage is real. I'm not going to go into the plot, but that was sort of the setup. And our title was Straight as an Arrow.
How'd it turn out?
I'll send you the link to Vimeo. It played downtown at the, it played downtown on Avenue A, and it was just in another film festival last week, Planet Connections Film Festival, which screens sort of socially relevant films and is sort of about the environment and sort of social progressivism, if you will. They invited us, so we had a second screening last week downtown on East 4th Street, and Oliver Power, the talented director, and I got to be in the talkback, which we did a fairly okay job and tried not to fumble it too badly.
Yeah, that's great. As soon as you send me the link, I'll put it on the our Facebook page too, so anyone who listens to this can see it.
Great.
So let's talk about process a little more. I know you're somebody who thrives on collaboration, which is interesting for writers, because the prototypical image of a writer is someone sitting alone in their room. But you're someone with an agency background where you're surrounded by people all the time. And do you have a future that you've written alone, or has each one has had a co-writer?
That's a good question. I'd have to go back and check. I have written short films by myself. I actually wrote The Golem of Avenue B all by myself, but I felt that I needed a polish. And then I asked Jenny to help me punch it up. But I originally wrote The Golem of Avenue B for the Independent Film Project in New York for their emerging narratives. And I got into the finals with it. So I think that's probably my key. I wrote it myself. Mm-hmm. Because I was in advertising post-Mad Men, when the era... the golden era of the art director, copywriter collaboration, whereas the guy responsible for the pictures and the guy responsible for the words would sit together in a room and brainstorm. I guess that kind of creative crucible is, in my formative years, that's what sort of tuned me into collaboration, which is a good thing. Because as you know, John, if you make a film, if you're making an ad campaign, if you're making a web video, excuse me, you have to work with a lot of people. And you've got to be able to take criticism. You've got to be able to check your ego at the door. And you've got to keep your own creative vision and play nicely with others all at the same time.
Right. I always feel that collaboration's really important, because eventually, no matter what you work on, someone else is going to see it and judge it. So
it might as well
have the first person who sees it and judges it to be someone you trust and someone that can help it.
Exactly.
Rather than, I'm going to finish this all myself, and I don't know if anyone else in the world but me will like it.
Right. Right. Well, it's sort of the difference between sitting in a cold, unlit loft, mumbling to yourself over an open can of beans, "I could have been somebody," or going out or going out in the world and trying to make the best. To make the best of your contacts and your opportunities.
Right, yeah, or in our case, going to Burger Heaven.
Right, exactly. Which, sadly, on Madison Avenue, that Burger Heaven closed, and the buildings.
Oh.
Yeah, and Wonderman moved to 3 Columbus Circle. They moved out of there. I think they're turning the building into condos.
Yeah, well, they moved out of there after that.
Yeah.
The tragedy in the
fatal elevator accident. But they were already scheduled to move out when that happened.
Okay. So, yeah, those elevators were the worst. When we both worked in that building, they were always rickety. They always took forever.
I know.
And it was a matter of time before.
It's scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine what it was like to go back. I talked to you that day, and I remember I can imagine what it's like to go back. And we worked on like the 14th floor, so there's nobody to take the stairs every day.
No, there wasn't. Eerie.
Yeah. So this is probably the worst segue in the world. But talking about genre, I know you've done a lot of horror. Is that what you're drawn most to, or is there a reason that you go back to that genre?
It used to be, and I really like sci-fi and horror. Mm-hmm. The one thing I don't like is torture porn, which there seems to be a lot of that, or just absolutely blood and guts for the sake of it. Mm-hmm. I get really uneasy watching it. I know it's just a movie, but because I don't like it, I don't like to write it. Secondly, right now there are so many tropes. There are so many tropes on either zombies or vampires or what may be. It just seems to be so played out. So I'm just trying to think about the next thing I write to be something that's a little different from what people have done. And you and I were speaking earlier before this recording about maybe we'll, you know, what that might be. What have people not done?
What have people? Yeah, you know? I think as much as I love horror, it was never my favorite. I'm obviously, because of the show, superheroes are probably my favorite genre and comedy. But I do love sci-fi. I learned to love horror. I was way too afraid of it as a child to watch any of it. Except when I was about 11 or 12, I started watching the Bela Lugosi and the Boris Karloff movies. And then slowly, but I was end of college adulthood before I started watching things like Evil Dead and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But yeah, I think probably the best good and the most harm done to horror is that we have weekly television shows now, that we have vampire and zombie television shows that are doing stories every single week. It's very hard to not deplete the reservoir of stories.
Right. When there are now two TV series about fallen angels, not one, but two.
Yeah, we're going to have
that in and of itself, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, the CW is going to have iZombie, which means we're going to have two zombie shows, and then if The Walking Dead does a spinoff, that's three.
And there's a zombie show on BBC America now called In the Flesh. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, and they also had the was it Being Human or Almost Human?
Being Human is like a punchline to a joke. It's a ghost, a werewolf, and a vampire rent an apartment.
Right, and there was a period.
Roommates. It was a BBC show, and then it became a Sci-Fi Network show as well. Actually, both of them are pretty good. Among those shows, those are both. I'd say they're excellent. How many shows can you have on that?
I know, but it's funny with that show too, because both of them were running at the same time.
Right,
and which is the first time I've seen that done with a British show. Usually, the British show's wrapped up like The Office before they make an American version. And I was like, "All right, I can't watch them both. Tell me which one is better." And nobody could say which one was definitively better.
That's where episode recaps come in really handy.
Yeah, we're getting to the point of the Cliff Notes of television now, where it's like I'll just watch the episode recaps. It'll take me 20 minutes, and then I can move on.
Too scared to see that movie? Go to themoviespoiler.com.
Then you can have a conversation with people.
Right, exactly. You can be relevant without forking over your 11, 12 bucks or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how there's always that one show or that one movie in the zeitgeist, and if you don't want to see it, you're at a loss. I've talked about this before. I gave up on Game of Thrones in season 2. And until Orange is the New Black came back, I couldn't talk to anybody. Because they weren't talking about it because I wanted to talk about Breaking Bad, but it was over. So
I am sort of working my way through season 1 of Breaking Bad. But
oh my God,
nobody
it's so
wants
good.
To talk about it anymore. So
because now it's done. Well, the problem with that show is as great as it is, and I think it's I think it will always be great. I think it is one of those shows that won't get dated.
Yeah.
It's so full of spoilers that when you look back at that show, it was a complete story from beginning to end. I always say it's the only series I've ever seen where its best episode was its final episode. Because it just got better, 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 finished. But so you see it as one series. You don't see it as this is my favorite episode and this moment is great. So nobody wants to talk about it because nobody wants to spoil anything.
Yeah.
You know, because you mentioned a character, and I'll immediately think of, oh, when that guy died. Oh, my God. So right. I think we're getting to a point with television where it is like reading novels, where, you know, novels have this timeless quality of they're all about when you discover it.
Right.
You know, right now somebody's reading J.D. Salinger for the first time.
Yep.
But, yeah, it is that, like, whatever's going on right now is whatever's going on right now, and it'll be replaced very, very quickly.
True. Well, I am enjoying Orange is the New Black, though.
Yeah,
I just watched episode two. So.
Yeah,
and season two. Episode two, season two. I'm ready for episode three.
We are in episode four. Renee and I were watching it last night, and our Wi-Fi dropped out. And then, yeah, we were in the middle of it, and we were trying to get the Wi-Fi back, and then I realized that she had not seen the latest episode of Fargo, so we watched it. Have you been watching Fargo?
You know, I haven't. Not yet. Is it good?
It's like really it? Good. Yeah, I'm sure it'll come on Netflix, and they have one episode left. Don't watch it now. But they managed to tell a new story.
I can get it on demand, too.
Yeah, the whole series is there. It's really worth it. They managed to kind of get that Coen Brothers feeling without doing an imitation, and they're telling – I didn't realize this till I got into it, so it's not a spoiler. I initially thought they were going to remake the movie as 10 episodes.
Right.
They're not doing that at all. They're telling a new story with new characters that has it has the film noir in that white snow and with that sunny Midwesternness. So they managed to capture that balance of tone that the Coen brothers did in that one episode. And you know, it stars Martin Freeman and Billy Bob Thornton, and there's been just a great people coming and going, so the acting is high caliber.
Yeah.
So it's great, and it replaced Justified in the same time slot, so I just kept watching FX on Wednesday nights.
I'm a big, big Elmore Leonard and Justified fan.
Yeah, so
huge.
Am I. That's another show that they don't work as hard to capture the tone of Elmore Leonard as Fargo does to the Coen brothers, but they managed to get what Elmore Leonard does right. You know, both in his crime novels and in his Western novels.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's been great. It only has one season left, but it's like,
yeah,
it's the kind of show where I always felt that if Justified and Community were on Netflix streaming right now, they would both be much bigger hits than they are.
I think so.
Yeah. So what else are you watching?
What else am I watching? I'm about to watch, I guess, season three of Falling Skies. Which is on one of the Turner networks. It's either TNT or TBS.
Mm-hmm.
It is the premise of Falling Skies is an alien race has come down and they're going to sort of ruin Earth, take the minerals, enslave the people. And these are the hardy band of survivors formed the 4th Massachusetts Regiment. And there is a somewhat government in exile fighting the aliens, and just when all is lost, another alien race comes down and helps them. It's actually very good.
Yeah, it's been one of those shows for
some
reason.
It's a Spielberg. Spielberg produces it.
Okay, really? It's been one of those shows that I've heard about, but you're the first person I know that's watched it, and I think
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I think we're at an age now where if I don't know someone personally to recommend a show, I probably won't get into it.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much out there, you can't even follow the talent. As you said, it's a Spielberg show.
I'm also watching Penny Dreadful.
Oh, how is
on
that?
On Showtime. I'm enjoying it immensely. It's very literary and very literate. And it also, it's somewhat, to me, like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah,
because
well,
the characters... The characters in the show, which is in the sort of late Victorian era, are Victor Frankenstein, Dorian Gray, who else? The monster created by Victor Frankenstein. There is a Wild West guy who's just, he's sort of like a Buffalo Bill, I guess, a sharpshooter.
Mm-hmm.
He's played by Josh Hartnett, but it's a non-literary character. There is a woman who is a medium. There are Egyptologists. There are vampires, but not Dracula.
Yeah.
There
I know.
Go
I know.
Ahead.
Eva. I know Eva Green's in it. I'm a big fan of Eva Green.
She's great. She's terrific.
Yeah, ever since Casino Royale.
Yeah.
I've loved her. I'm actually, she's one of the reasons I'm looking forward to Sin City 2.
And Timothy Dalton is sort of the head of this clan of evil fighters, and he's sensational.
Wow, that is a bigger cast than I realized. I didn't realize Josh Hartnett or Timothy Dalton were in it.
Yeah. Very good. Reeve Carney, Broadway's Frankenstein, is in the Broadway's Spider-Man, excuse me, is in the show.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I regret that I never got to see Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. It opened right when I moved out of New York. Mm-hmm. And then I think last year we were coming in and we were trying to see it, and it had just closed.
Yeah.
It seemed so – I had friends that went to it. It was just such a fascinating train wreck of like good. All the right ingredients and none of them coming together.
Great flying, though. It actually reminds me when my son Josh was really young. He was like maybe 5 or 6. We went to Radio City to see the live stage version of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Oh my God, I didn't know they did that.
And the level of acting was somewhat. The pyrotechnics and the flying were great, but the book was maybe one step above, you know, I'll stop you now, Skeletor. Ha ha, not so fast, He-Man.
Yeah.
That's sort of what Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark was a bit like.
Did you see it? You saw Spider-Man?
Oh, we did, yeah.
Oh, so was that your major problem? And did you see the first version or the second version? Because the second version, they got Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, who was a Marvel writer, to rewrite it.
I think I saw the first version.
Oh, the first version was a real train wreck.
Here's what I have to say. Being somebody like you, being a creative person, I'm really loath to criticize a sincere effort.
Yeah, yeah.
I think everybody tried really hard. Mm-hmm. I think just somehow it didn't come together. I actually thought the performances were very good for mm-hmm. what they were. And I think the guy who played the Green Goblin was a terrific, larger-than-life stage villain. And I think the guy who played Spider-Man did a great job. For reasons that I can't quite figure out, it didn't quite gel. But there was a lot of good work and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into that show.
Yeah, I've always wondered about downloading just a soundtrack just to hear the U2 songs.
Right.
Just to hear like a U2 album about Spider-Man. I would imagine it's kind of like that Prince album he did for Batman.
Well, the music actually was good, but I don't think it was traditional Broadway music. It was more like power pop or arena pop.
Right, and which maybe, is what U2 is.
Yeah. I think U2 were great.
Yeah, it wasn't pure musical.
Yeah.
So what are you looking forward to? What's coming up on the radar that you really want
to
see?
What am I looking forward to? I want to mention that I just saw Kenneth Branagh's staging of Macbeth at the Park Avenue Armory in New York, where this is a huge space, which used to be a National Guard armory. He put in bleachers, put dirt on the floor, and had sword fighting and dying and flying witches. And I'm telling you, this was every bit as kinetic as Spider-Man.
Wow.
And this was the best Shakespeare I've ever seen. So I'm glad I saw that. I'm looking forward. I have not had a chance to see Godzilla, the new X-Men, both of which I want to see. And I'm interested to see The Edge of Tomorrow, which maybe isn't getting the buzz, but I hear it's really smart and really good. So I'm looking forward to seeing it next week.
Yeah, I just talked to somebody, saw X-Men, and mm-hmm. we did a whole episode. I missed Godzilla because I heard mixed, and I'm not a big enough fan of the franchise to get a babysitter and run to it if I'm hearing so-so reviews.
Right.
But Edge of Tomorrow, I just talked to somebody yesterday who really liked the reviews I'm hearing of that are like it's the first really good Tom Cruise movie in a long time.
Yeah, that's what I hear. So the first Tom Cruise movie in a while. I thought actually War of the Worlds, I thought it was a super remake.
Yeah, I thought it was really fascinating. War of the Worlds, mm-hmm. there was that period of Spielberg between AI, War of the Worlds, and Minority Report where he was mm-hmm. he was going hard sci-fi and using Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I didn't think any of those movies were particularly great, certainly not in the way that Indiana Jones or Close Encounters or
they were great. I like to call them popcorn movies. To borrow from SCTV, it blowed up real good.
Yeah, but I thought they were all really interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, now I don't think we even mentioned it. Now you are officially retired from advertising.
Right.
So over 40 years.
Semi-retired, as I sort of said before we started on.
You're not going to go in every day anymore.
No way. not a chance, but I have a very good relationship with the company that I left, and we have talked about maybe doing a sort of a mixture of a take-home project or going in a little bit. So if they're nice enough to do that, I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, so, I will say that that's been the plus side of technology. As you said before, you know, we've all gone 24/7 where we're just working around the clock and you know, we're getting work in our phone, in our pocket at any moment of the day. But the flip side of that is more and more companies seem amenable to you just staying home and doing it and emailing it in.
Well, when I was working on this, we had a West Coast client. The creative team sat in New York. The account people sat in San Francisco, and the client was in San Francisco. And other than the time zone, everything was, there were conference calls, work was exchanged over either email or file sharing services, and everything went smoothly. So it's a different world.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lateral move in some ways.
Exactly. If you want to see how much the world has changed, just put Blade Runner into the DVD or stream it. That or an old Star Trek, and you just you roar at the antiquated technology of the quote-unquote feature.
Well, I love
future.
The next...
Yeah.
Yes, Star Trek especially, because the next generation... The original series now has this like great 60s retro look to it.
Yeah.
But Next Generation wanted to be so advanced, and we have everything that ship has, other than transporters and light speed.
Exactly right. When Captain Jean-Luc Picard used to read his Shakespeare, his Dickens, it's like he's holding a Kindle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they all had laptops on their desks.
I know, and speech recognition. It's you know, you could say Google. What is the circumference of Mars as opposed to computer?
Yeah, it's Siri. The entire ship
had
Siri.
Exactly, they had Siri.
There was a great quote from Pete Holmes, who I knew, who had the show after Conan for a while. He said, "I can't watch Star Trek anymore because now it just looks like people Skyping each other." Which is
funny.
Exactly what we're doing now. Basically, we're creating a radio show and just talking to you on the phone.
I'm talking to you on my communicator.
Exactly.
Which would be a 1996 model Motorola flip phone, right?
But congratulations on the retirement.
Well, thank you.
So congratulations on
keeping your sanity and having a job and two boys and, you know, a wife will still talk to you.
Yeah, you know what?
A roaring success.
I didn't realize how much I needed that congratulations until someone who understood it told me. So what's your focus now? What's the next big project?
My big project now is I'm co-writing a book with a very talented woman named Anne Glauber for Changing Lives Press. The name of the book is Falling to Grace, and it is about people who have lost their position, their power, their wealth, or some other condition through a horrendous misstep. And through prayer, meditation, thought, hard work, whatever, they end up coming back better and stronger than they were before. We talked to an actress whose career was ruined. We talked to a minister, an evangelical minister who was a closeted gay man who came out to his congregation on the pulpit, and he actually lost. He lost his congregation, and the church went into foreclosure. His family stuck by him, and now he's a very, very successful minister in Atlanta, but he is in a different denomination, obviously. We spoke to a newscaster who was fired for not incorrect incorrect information, which was not, but he was sort of jammed out of his job by some network bigwigs. We spoke to a politician who was in Congress, did time for improper financial doings, and now meditates and goes out with the Dalai Lama to help the poor. So those are just a few of the people we talked to.
As always, you can follow me at Not On My Book. That is the Twitter feed for Caffeinated Comics. Like our Facebook page. That's where most of the news happens in between our episodes. And visit Chimera Comics and see Steven at 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. Talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not On My Book production.
Take that, meatball!